From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The graduation address of Mumia Abu-Jamal at Evergreen State College in Washington. Also, the occupation of Kosovo, an audio diary with Jeremy Scahill. All that and more coming up from Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The first of more than 1,200 U.S. Marines began entering Kosovo to take up positions in what will become the U.S.-controlled zone of the Yugoslav province, while diplomats struggled to find a compromise with Russian leaders over the role that nation's military will play in the peace operation. President Clinton planned to speak today with Russian President Boris Yeltsin about Russia's role in the Kosovo peace operation. In an hour-long telephone conversation yesterday, the two leaders agreed their generals should work out a role for the 200 Russian troops already in Kosovo, while talks continue on command arrangements for a larger Russian contingent. Russia deployed 200 troops into Kosovo's capital, Pristina, in a surprise move before NATO troops entered the province on Saturday morning. They have since barred Allied peacekeepers from the capital's airport, which was to be the headquarters of the British-run command. With 5,000 British, French, Italian, German, and Dutch troops securing their positions around the province, the NATO peacekeeping mission saw its first casualties yesterday, two armed men shot dead by soldiers in separate incidents. Three German journalists were also killed. Two were shot in their car by unidentified armed men south of Pristina on Sunday, this according to the German Foreign Ministry. The third was found dead this morning near the central Kosovo town of Suvorica. Russia's role in the envisaged 50,000-strong peacekeeping force, which includes 7,000 Americans, was not clearly defined when the peace deal was struck with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. But the surprise insertion of some 200 Russian troops into Pristina has given Russia a stronger hand in bargaining its role with the West. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, returning home after 3 days of negotiations in Moscow, said the United States was considering giving the Russians, quote, a zone of responsibility under NATO command. Finance ministers from the Group of Seven industrial countries agreed in Frankfurt over the weekend that existing debt relief arrangements for poor countries should be made deeper and wider. The scheme will be finalized at the Cologne G7 Leaders Summit next weekend. The plan would increase the number of highly indebted poor countries eligible for relief from 29 to 36. Development lobby groups such as Jubilee 2000 gave a muted welcome to the G7 debt plan, as thousands of demonstrators gathered on the banks of the River Thames in London to press the case for more ambitious debt cancellation. This news from Panama City. Researchers at Panama State University have found an ominous thinning of the ozone layer over the country in the first such research carried out in Central America. At a recent conference, the researchers warned the thinning of the ozone layer over the country could drive up the incidence of skin cancer and cataracts and cause immune system damages among the local population. Brazil is getting ready to offer sections of Latin America's largest country for exploration to foreign oil companies after the breakup of a 46-year state monopoly. Most of the world's biggest oil companies are to bid for 27 potential oil and gas sites at a massive auction on Tuesday and Wednesday. Among 37 bidders are Shell, Esso, Texaco, and Mobil. With a final flurry of activity, federal prosecutors are concluding a 20-month investigation into whether the New York City Police Department's response to brutality by its officers is so feeble that it breeds a climate that fosters acts of excessive force. In a month or so, city officials expect Zachary Carter, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of New York, to present them with a series of findings on managerial practices by the department, focusing particularly on how officers are disciplined. The reports will be the basis for negotiations between the city and the federal government on possible changes in police procedures. If the negotiations break down, the prosecutors have the power to file a lawsuit to compel the Giuliani administration to make the recommended changes. George W. Bush plunged into the 2000 presidential race this weekend, declaring, quote, "There's no turning back," from his bid to usher in a new era of Republican politics. Flying from Austin aboard his Great Expectations charter plane, the Texas governor embarked on his first campaign trip, already positioned as the party's leader in polls, money raising, and endorsements. Among Bush's policy proposals were promises to reduce marginal tax rates, allow Americans to invest their Social Security taxes, and add a touch of iron to the U.S. military. He leveled one attack against President Clinton and Vice President Gore, saying they did not invent prosperity in America. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In the next two segments of the show, we will be going to Pristina, where Pacifica reporter Jeremy Scahill has been observing the occupation of Kosovo, and he will bring us a radio diary. But right now, in the first segment of today's program, we're going to bring you the graduation speech given by Mumia Abu-Jamal last Friday. On that day, the commencement ceremony at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, had caps, gowns, and the words of Mumia Abu-Jamal echoing throughout the exercise for 13 minutes. A handful of the approximately 800 graduates walked out as Abu-Jamal's audio tape speech was played on Friday for the audience of several thousand. Two dozen other graduates stood and turned their backs, and still others wore yellow armbands of support as thousands listened to the speech. Protesters, including Maureen Faulkner, the widow of the Philadelphia police officer who Abu-Jamal was convicted of shooting in 1981, also attended the ceremony. Student selection of Abu-Jamal as a speaker turned into a political tempest. Washington Governor Gary Locke canceled his scheduled appearance at the ceremony. Majority Whip Tom DeLay took to the House floor Thursday to ask for a moment of silence to protest the student's choice. Abu-Jamal's jailhouse writings about the justice system and his efforts to win a new trial have given him worldwide attention. He has become a symbol for death penalty opponents. Students who supported Abu-Jamal's inclusion in the ceremony said he was invited to, quote, not to create a lot of bad feelings, but rather to create a forum for a marginalized segment of our society. In his remarks, Abu-Jamal, the former Black Panther, drew parallels between British colonial rule and Black U.S. political power. On Friday, we had a discussion about the speech before it was given. We were joined by the vice president of Evergreen State College, who refused to back down and insisted they would go ahead with the speech. And we were joined by Gary Bell, who is the partner of Daniel Faulkner. But today, we will bring you the speech of Mumia Abu-Jamal that was recorded on tape and played for the thousands at the graduation ceremony.
Students of Evergreen, and thank you for this invitation. On the move, long live John Africa. I feel privileged to address your chosen theme, not because I'm some kind of avatar, but because a life lived deliberately has been the example of people that I admire and respect, such as Malcolm X, Dr. Huey P. Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party, like Ramona Africa, who survived the hellish bombing by police of May 13, 1985, or the Move 9, committed rebels now Why was it right for people to revolt against the British because of, quote, taxation without representation, unquote, and somehow wrong for truly unrepresented Africans in America to revolt against America? For any oppressed people, revolution, according to the Declaration of Independence, is a right. Malcolm X, although now widely acclaimed as a black nationalist martyr, was vilified at the time of his assassination by Time magazine as, quote, an unashamed demagogue, unquote, who, quote, was a disaster to the civil rights movement, unquote. The New York Times would describe him as a, quote, twisted man, unquote, who used his brains and oratorical skills for, quote, an evil purpose, unquote. Today, there are schools named for him, and recently, a postage stamp was even issued in his honor. Dr. Huey P. Newton, Ph.D., founded the Black Panther Party in October of 1966 and created one of the most militant and principled organizations American blacks had ever seen. J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI targeted the party, using every foul and underhanded method they could conceive of to neutralize the group, which they described as the, quote, number one threat to national security, unquote. Since Ramona Africa of the MOVE organization survived one of the most remarkable bombings in American history, one where Philadelphia police massacred 11 men, women, and children living in the MOVE house and destroyed some 61 homes in the vicinity. She did 7 years in the state prison on riot charges, came out, and began doing all she could to spread the teachings of John Africa, the teachings of revolution, and to free her imprisoned brothers and sisters of MOVE from their repressive century in hellish prison cells. These people dared to dissent, dared to speak out, dared to reject the status quo by becoming rebels against it. They lived, and some of them continue to live, lives of deliberate will, of willed resistance to a system that is killing us. Remember them, honor their highest moments, learn from them. Are these not lives lived deliberately? This system's greatest fear has been that folks like you, young people, people who've begun to critically examine the world around them, some perhaps for the first time, people who have yet to have the spark of life snuffed out, would do just that, learn from those lives, be inspired, and then live lives of opposition to the deadening status quo. Let me give you an example. A young woman walks into a courtroom, one situated in the cradle of American democracy, that's Philadelphia, to do some research for a law class. This woman, who dreams of becoming a lawyer, sits down and watches the court proceedings and is stunned by what she sees. She sees defendants prevented from defending themselves, manhandled in court, and cops lying on the stand with abandon. She saw the judge as nothing more than an administrator of injustice and saw U.S. law as an illusion. Her mind reeled as she said to herself, "They can't do that," as her eyes saw them doing whatever they wanted to. Well, that young woman is now known as Ramona Africa, who lived her life deliberately after attending several sessions of the MOVE trial in Philadelphia. After that far, she knew she could never be a part of a legal system that allowed it, and she found more truth in the teachings of John Africa than she ever could in the law books, which promised a kind of justice that was foreign to the courtrooms she had seen. The contrast between America's lofty promises and the truth of its legal repression inspired her to be a revolutionary, one that America 41 shots at an unarmed man in the doorway of his own apartment building. Huey, at least in his earlier years, lived his life deliberately and set the mark as a revolutionary. What was the difference between Huey Newton and you? Absolutely nothing, except he made that choice. Each of the Move 9, including the late Merle Africa, who died under somewhat questionable circumstances after 19 years into an unjust prison sentence. Members of the Move organization whose trial initially attracted the attention of a young law student named Ramona decades ago was a person who came to question their lives, has lived in the system. Some were U.S. Marines, some were petty criminals, some were carpenters, but all came to the point of questioning the status quo, deeply, honestly, and completely, irrevocably. One by one, they turned their back on a system that they knew couldn't care less if they lived or died, and joined the revolution after being exposed to the stirring teachings of John Africa. They individually chose to live life deliberately and joined MOVE. And although they are individuals, Delbert Africa, Janet Africa, Phil Africa, Janine Africa, Chucky Africa, Mike Africa, Debbie Africa, and Eddie Africa, they are also united as MOVE members, united in heart and soul. What's the difference between the Move 9 and you? Absolutely nothing, except they made a choice. Now, unless I miss my guess, Evergreen is not a predominantly black institution. And my choice has heretofore given may seem somewhat strange to too many of you. For far too many of you may identify yourselves by the fictional label of white. In truth, as I'm sure many of you know, race is a social construct. That said, it is still a social reality formed by our histories and our cultures. For those of you still bound by such realities, however, I have some names for you, like John Brown, like Dr. Alan Bergman, Susan Rosenberg, Sue Africa, Marilyn Buck, for example. Each of these people are, or were, known in America as white. They're all people I know of, who I admire, love, and respect. They are all, or were, revolutionaries. John Brown's courageous band's attack on Harper's Ferry was one deeply religious man's strike against the hated slavery system and was indeed considered one of the opening salvos of the U.S. Civil War. Dr. Alan Bergman, Susan Rosenberg, and Marilyn Buck were all anti-imperialists who fought to free black revolutionary Assata Shakur from an unjust and cruel bondage. They are the spiritual grandsons and granddaughters of John Brown. Dr. Alan Bergman, Marilyn Buck, and Susan Rosenberg were treated like virtual traitors to white supremacy and thrown into American dungeons. Buck and Rosenberg remain so in prison today. They lived lives deliberately and chose liberation as their goal, understanding that our freedom is interconnected. They chose the hard road of revolution, yet they chose. And but for that choice, they're just like each of you seated here tonight. People who saw the evils of the system and resolved to fight it, period. Now, the name Sue Africa may not be known to you. She's what you may call white. Yet when she joined the MOVE organization, the system attacked her bitterly for what was seen as a betrayal of her white-skinned privilege. On May 13th, 1985, she lost her only son because the Philadelphia police bombed the house she was living in. She served over a decade in prison with the guards vilely taunting. take that to mean that social movements are begun by relatively small numbers of people who, as catalysts, inspire, provoke, and move larger numbers to see and share their vision. Social movements can then become social forces that expand our perspectives, open up new social possibilities, and create the consciousness for change. To begin this process, we must first sense that
the commencement address of Mumia Abu-Jamal at the graduation ceremony of Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say, say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart, remove all the bars that keep us apart.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman as we go now to Pristina, Kosovo, where Pacifica reporter Jeremy Scahill has been throughout the weekend as he observes and chronicles the occupation of Kosovo. Yugoslavia has put a dollar figure on the damage inflicted by NATO bombing, $30 to $35 billion. The country says several thousand civilians were killed, thousands more injured. A government spokesman says 35 hospitals were hit, in addition to more than 400 schools, factories, and other public buildings. United Nations Environment Program will conduct its own assessment at the end of the week. The U.S. and Britain say reconstruction funds will come only if Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic leaves office. Meanwhile, the occupation of Kosovo has begun by NATO forces, but not before. Russian troops, surprisingly, came into Kosovo and took the airport. Jeremy Scahill was there. Jeremy, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Today, you're going to be bringing our listeners an audio diary of the last 3 days, which has been quite remarkable for you. And I also just want to tell our listeners what a difficult situation Jeremy is in, as the situation is extremely tense. And we just got word, in addition to all of the troops moving in, there were three German journalists who have been killed over this last 3 days, one just found this morning in central Kosovo. So I know it's a very difficult situation, Jeremy.
Well, that's true, Amy. I mean, everywhere you go, you're being warned that there are snipers along the road. The KLA seems to have been given a great degree of liberty by the NATO forces to continue attacking people. And whenever journalists go outside of Pristina, their lives are literally in danger. The KLA had surrounded Serb civilian areas in Prizren, and that's where the German journalists were headed, and they were killed in a drive-by shooting. One of them died on the spot, and another one died after he was airlifted to try to get him treatment. You hear gunshots ringing out constantly. To drive along the roads is very, very dangerous. Those three journalists were killed, but there have been others that have been shot at. Many journalists here are wearing bulletproof vests, and some people describe the situation right now, not just in Pristina, but elsewhere, like the beginnings of a Beirut or the beginnings of a Belfast. You are constantly hearing gunshots ringing out. The tension level in the last 24 hours has risen dramatically. There is this security void that both the Yugoslav government talked about and NATO forces saying that they wanted to prevent. Well, that's right here, right now. That's what we are in the midst of, an absolute security vacuum. Pristina belongs to no one right now. There are still Serb forces walking the streets. There are KLA strongholds within the city. They have taken over schoolhouses and other areas. And then you have the reality of the NATO occupation. You have gigantic British tanks rolling through the city. There are Apache attack helicopters around. It very much gives the feel that it is a full-fledged occupation. But it also gives the feel of having warfare, an urban warfare on the streets. Tensions are enormously high between Serbians and Albanians, and attacks are happening. Just a few moments ago, we learned that a Serbian man was shot in his back after Albanians, possibly KLA, opened fire on him at a border point that they had established to try to prevent, they say, people from looting homes. Well, this man didn't stop his car, and apparently they opened fire on him and hit him in the back, and he is now in the hospital. So it's a very, very tense situation. I did come into Kosovo a few days ago, and as we drove in, we left Belgrade very, very early in the morning. And after we were driving for about an hour south, we started to see a steady stream of armored personnel carriers filing out of Kosovo. This was the beginnings of the Serbian troop withdrawals. The faces of the men that were coming out of there looked one of two things, very, very battered and destroyed, but also very, very relieved that they were getting out. Some of them waved the flag of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. Many of them held up the three-finger Yugoslavia salute. All of them seemed very, very happy to be leaving and relieved. And so we saw that, and we also saw townspeople gathering along the roads to greet the soldiers as they left, and we also saw Serbian civilians fleeing the country. Now, it's also interesting to note that among the military convoys that we saw, the Serb military convoys pulling out, we also saw large trucks full of appliances, washing machines, televisions, VCRs, etc., which is possible evidence that there has been looting, but these were being transported by military vehicles, and they also were combined with Serbian civilians that were leaving the country as well. And once we got actually into Pristina, the first impression that you get of Pristina is that it's a dead ghost town. You see people wandering around looking absolutely lost. I've seen many old people just looking absolutely confused as they walk around the rubble and the ruins that once was Pristina. I talked to one gypsy woman who said that it was the first time the night we got here that she had really gone out with her kids in nearly 2 months, and she had four or five children there standing with her. Now, I also experienced a great deal of unwillingness to talk to me, being a journalist from the United States. In fact, one older Serbian man said, "We've had it up to here," touching his forehead, and he said, "With you people, we're only speaking to the Russians." Well, this was the day that the Russians scooped NATO and scooped the rest of the forces and took Pristina solo. And the way that they did it was very, very interesting. They were a part of the S4 forces from Bosnia. And what they did was they quietly turned off their communication equipment. They painted over the S in the S4 and made it into a K for K4, the Kosovo force, and they rolled their tanks and trucks into the streets of Pristina. Thousands and thousands of people gathered on the streets here to welcome the Russian soldiers. Many, many Serbs here believe that the only force that would be on their side once the Serb forces are withdrawn would be Russian troops. So there was elation in the street and jubilation when they finally saw the Russians come through at about 1:30 a.m. just a few days ago. And as the Russians began their pulling into Pristina, there were several young Serbian men on top of a roof, and they began burning an American flag and chanting anti-American slogans, and we'll play some of that right now. That was the scene outside the streets of Pristina as the Russians pulled into town. Now, it's interesting to note that the Russians, in getting here before everyone else, were able to take over the most important location strategically in Kosovo, the Slatina Airport. And the day that we got in, six MiG-21s, Russian MiGs, flew overhead from Slatina. These were Yugoslav MiGs. And NATO had bombed that airfield very, very heavily, and it certainly was enraged, I think, that it saw that Yugoslavia still had these planes. And it sent a message not just to NATO but also to the Russians that not all has been destroyed. And so the Russians, as of now, still have Slatina, where they have an underground storage facility, and there is an ongoing standoff between Russian forces there. They have blocked the streets with a tank, and also the British forces that stand outside there. Many, many Serbians want the Russians to remain, but many, many Albanians want them to leave. Now, I also, yesterday, was at
Jeremy, just an understanding for listeners who perhaps weren't following events over the weekend, the foreign minister of Russia originally denied that the troops were moving in. Apparently, it may be that he didn't even know that they were, then said they would leave, and they haven't. And the commander in charge of these 200 Russian troops has just been promoted by Boris Yeltsin, as Boris Yeltsin is about to have his second conversation with Bill Clinton.
Yeah, and a couple of things appear like they could be very, very realistic. One would be that there was some sort of a deal cut between Belgrade and Moscow during the Chernomyrdin negotiations with Slobodan Milosevic, that there would be some sort of a security blanket provided for Serbian civilians within Kosovo, and that could come in the form of a Russian force serving as sort of a buffer between Serbian civilians and the KLA. So that would be one. The other is that there is a split in the Russian government between those who are leaning more toward a pro-NATO stance and those who are very much in line with the Russian military, which would advocate a harder line here in Belgrade, feeling that there was a total capitulation on the part of the Belgrade government and not wanting Russia to be a part of that. So that standoff is still very much going on. Now, that contrasts also with the entrance of NATO troops. We were there when they came up from Macedonia. These were British troops. And as they came in, they drove massive, massive tanks and armored personnel carriers and Apache helicopters flew overhead. And the British forces, which were the first to take Pristina, after the Russians, of course, came in, and they were led by the ruthless 1st Paratrooper Battalion, which has been known for murdering civilians on Bloody Sunday in Ireland, has been known for their brutality. In fact, some other British journalists here who cover defense issues describe them as just that, very ruthless. They were accompanied by the Gorkhas, which is a band of British-trained Nepalese soldiers who are also known for brutality, particularly toward women. Well, these were the first forces from NATO to see, quote-unquote, action in Kosovo. And they came in with their guns drawn, with massive knives, and with the Apache attack helicopters. And we want to just bring listeners a sense of what was there at that time by playing them some of the Apache helicopter sound followed by the tanks rolling in. Those were the Apache attack helicopters, and they also rolled in many, many tanks, dozens and dozens of tanks coming through. Now, Amy, I had a chance when the British were coming in to interview Brigadier Adrian Freer of the 1st Paratrooper Division, and I raised with him the issue of protection for Serb civilians from the KLA. This is something that many, many people are concerned about here. There are more than 150,000 Serbian civilians just a few weeks ago. Many, many people have left. You see large convoys of ethnic Serbs fleeing the country right now. In fact, one man sitting atop a tractor on one of these convoys said to me, first it was the Albanians' turn, and now it's ours. So I raised with Brigadier Adrian Freer the issue of protection from the KLA and whether or not they will be disarming the KLA like they are disarming the Serbian forces.
Have you encountered KLA?
We have seen some KLA, yes.
Were you disarming them as well?
No, we weren't, because this is very, very sensitive. And, of course, what one's got to do here is ensure that the place can start to come back to normality.
Sure.
And, you know, we're not an occupying force, we're a peacemaking force, and to facilitate rebuilding this province.
That was Brigadier Adrian Freer of the British Army. I also had a chance
Jeremy,
to interview...
Jeremy, yeah. That is very significant, that comment of Brigadier General Adrian Freer. Him saying when you asked if they would be disarming the KLA, no, that they are a peacekeeping force, not an occupying force, because yesterday and over the weekend overall, when all of the administration spokespeople came out, officials like Madeleine Albright and William Cohen, Shelton, the Joint Chiefs of Staff chair, they don't make it very clear that the KLA is not actually being disarmed. They talk about demilitarized, but they're not often questioned about what that means.
Exactly. And just today, I was on a scene where K-4 forces were present, and I saw openly KLA soldiers in KLA uniform walking around with machine guns right next to NATO tanks. So I think that there is a very valid and legitimate fear on the part of civilians here that the KLA is being allowed to just step up its campaign and get stronger holds within Kosovo. Now, it's also interesting to note a soldier who wouldn't say this to me on tape but did say it off the tape told me that the KLA, in fact, was coming in behind the British forces. So there does appear to be a complicity between NATO and the KLA in allowing them to move in. I had a chance to clarify with a U.S. Army spokesperson what they mean by disarm versus demilitarization. This is Army Major Troy Cate.
What about interaction with the KLA? How is that going to be handled?
The political powers are working on the interaction between the KLA, but they've already said publicly that they support the military technical agreement, and they also signed the Rambouillet agreement, so we're hoping for full support from the KLA.
Well, they, and as part of the agreement also, if I'm not mistaken, was a demilitarization of the KLA.
That's correct.
How will that be carried out?
Well, once we establish liaisons with the KLA and it's worked out politically, then we'll go down and do the finer points.
Does NATO foresee any sort of a military future for the KLA, or is the stance of NATO that they should be completely disarmed?
No, not disarmed, demilitarized.
Could you explain the difference?
The difference is you don't have people with heavy weapons. They can keep their own low-level weapons, but the exact details still have to be worked out.
Right. So the general idea then is to wait and see what comes out of the political discussions regarding the future of the KLA?
That's correct, and there are talks going on at a higher level than here on the ground with them.
Are all of the Apaches going to be brought in that were originally brought over?
I do not know. They've been used for a convoy escort, et cetera, for force protection at the moment. But until we figure out exactly where we're going, I have to let them decide.
And what sort of a timetable are we looking at for return of refugees?
That is up to the UNHCR. We have asked the refugees for some patience, and for the most part, they understood. And let us create the right environment, a safe environment, so they can... back into their homes.
Now, I was in a village yesterday talking with lots and lots of ethnic Serbs that are leaving, and they feel that NATO is not going to protect them from the KLA.
Yeah, well, NATO is here to do a job even-handedly against all parties, regardless of ethnic background, and that's what we're going to do. That's part of our mission statement, and that's what we're going to do.
So you're confident that you would be able to protect Serb civilians from attacks possibly from the KLA?
We're going to enforce the signing of the military technical agreement and keep it even-handedly to all parties.
Now, during the Gulf War, the Apache helicopters were armed with depleted uranium. Will that be the case here?
No idea. Not competent enough to speak on what they're carrying on their aircraft right now.
That was Army Major Troy Cate, and this is becoming an increasingly serious issue as we just heard gunshots a few moments ago once again in the streets of Pristina. It does appear as though the KLA is coming out of the mountains and moving into the city. We have seen visual proof of this. They are open. They say that they are not afraid anymore because NATO is here, and it does not appear that any significant disarmament of the KLA is taking place.
Jeremy,
Jeremy,
we have to break for stations to identify themselves, but when we come back, we're going to go to the section of your audio diary where you talk about what you've been witnessing also on the streets of Pristina. For example, the burning of the building next to the Muslim mosque that was Albanian, as well as your visit to a community of Albanians who ended up staying right near the airport and the what they suffered in these last few months. We're talking to Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Pristina, Kosovo. He has been witnessing the occupation of Kosovo. We'll be back with him here on Democracy Now! In just a minute.
Come get out of the way, boys. Quit quick, get out of the way. You'd better watch what you say, boys. Better watch what you say. We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fort. 'Cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. We pick and choose as we please, boys. Pick and choose as we please. You'd best get down on your knees, boys. Best get down on your knees.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Our war and peace report continues now for more than 80 days. Jeremy Scahill joins us from Pristina, Kosovo, Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Correspondent, who has been witnessing the occupation of Kosovo. At the beginning of our discussion, Jeremy, we talked about the three German reporters who have been killed, the last one found this morning in central Kosovo. Again, we don't know who killed any of those journalists. Is that right? Unidentified army men, unidentified armed men.
Yeah, they were. We have no confirmation yet from either side, from the military or other sources here, on who exactly it was that shot them. I talked with a U.S. Army spokesperson this morning that said only that they were killed in a drive-by shooting of sorts. Now, it's interesting. They were killed in Prizren. This has been a very, very intense place during the last 24 to 30 hours. The situation there is very, very grim for all parties involved. In fact, the Orthodox Archbishop, Father Artemius, was surrounded by the KLA in Prizren yesterday, and there were reports that the KLA was moving in on Prizren, and we did see convoys of hundreds and hundreds of vehicles of villagers fleeing Prizren, both Serbian and ethnic Albanians leaving, but certainly more Serbians were pulling out than ethnic Albanians, and I had a chance on the side of the road to talk to some of those Serbian refugees who were fleeing about what was happening in Prizren.
Prizren je kompletno iseljen od terorista.
Officers of Prizren were forced to leave.
They're
burning their houses, killing people, raping women.
That was a man on the road leaving Prizren and heading toward what he said Serbia. People feel very much like Kosovo is no longer a part of Yugoslavia and is heading in the direction of being independent despite all of the agreements. Now, Amy, I've also seen significant evidence of the campaign against the ethnic Albanians here. Driving into Kosovo, we saw several shattered out Albanian businesses, hundreds of torched homes, completely abandoned, burnt to the ground. And on some of these, we also saw graffiti. I saw graffiti on the side of an Albanian business that had been completely burned and looted out. And that graffiti just simply said across it in red spray paint, Serbia. And it had a big splash of blood red paint across it. Well, you see those sorts of scenes all over the place. And the horror stories abound from Albanians who are either just returning to their homes from the mountains now or have remained throughout. And I had a chance to talk to one very elderly ethnic Albanian who says he witnessed a horrific scene.
Dete, 8 godina, 8, zazvali, majku zazvali, dete, prizad, krvi, cijel noć, dete, majku.
They slaughtered the father and the mother of an 8-year-old boy. I was wiping the blood off the boy's face the whole night.
Namon, namon, Selima, namon, otac mu je Selim. I ušli unutra, zazvali profesor bio. Zaklali i ženu, a žete, 8 godina, cijel noć mu prišao krvi, majku, nije znao da je mrtav.
They were my neighbors. Two men came in their house. They slaughtered the father. His name was Salim. Salim was a professor. I was wiping the blood of the boy's face all night, and he didn't know that his mother was dead.
Now, Amy, that was an old Albanian man who was standing right across the street from British tanks as they rolled in. Many, many ethnic Albanians were overjoyed to see the NATO forces come in. Young children lined the streets as they did come in, giving them flowers and other gifts. This in contrast to the Serbian greeting to the Russian soldiers. But the ethnic Albanians feel very much like NATO is on their side. NATO is here to protect them. And you also get a sense that there's a sentiment here from many that it's time for all Serbians to leave. Now, that certainly is not the belief of all ethnic Albanians here, but that is something that we hear a lot, saying that they represent something to the Albanians that they can't live with anymore. Now, I also got to talk further with this Albanian man on where he is from and what has happened to his village.
He's
from the village Velika Reka.
Yes, porušili sve.
And they completely destroyed that village, burned down the houses.
Zapalili sve, celo kao celo.
And NATO is here to save them.
Ja sam sa evo tu. Na od vas dana da idem. Ništa nema. Ništa. Sve plaćali, sve. Zapalili. Sve.
They burned out everything. Robbed everything.
That was the old Albanian man standing across the street from the British soldiers as they came into Pristina. And there is a full-fledged occupation of Pristina right now. You do see tanks rolling down the streets. You see soldiers wide out in the opening. And yesterday, Amy, actually, I was on the scene shortly after a fire had broken out at a house. Now, this is a scene that you do see throughout the country, throughout Kosovo, actually. You see homes burning. You see offices burning. You see businesses burning. Some of those obviously are being burned by Serbian forces pulling out. This is something that the ethnic Albanians here fear very, very much. And the scene that I was on yesterday was right next door to a mosque. Now, there are varied reports on what exactly the burning building was, but one way of looking at it was that it was the registry to the mosque. There were other reports that it was the home of the imam of the mosque. And there was a third report that it actually was a Serbian police headquarters and that Serbian forces were burning it as they withdrew, which is a pattern that we have seen here. Now, I was one of the first journalists on the scene here with the building burning next to the mosque, and I saw something that not a lot of other journalists did see, and that was when we pulled up next to this building that was engulfed in flames, I saw several Yugoslav army soldiers standing across the street smiling. One of them gave a grin to me and put up the three-fingered Yugoslav salute. Well, within moments, they were gone as other journalists poured in, and I had a chance to talk to a young Albanian student as we stood outside of this burning building, and he talked about who he thought would do this.
Because I see a shot there, and it's Albanian, and I think the house is too Albanian.
So who do you think would have burned down an Albanian house?
Maybe in that neighborhood or revenge or something, I don't know.
Are you Albanian?
Yes. And student.
Do you see burning houses a lot?
Yes. I was all the time here in Pristina. I'm not from Pristina, but I'm studying here, and I was all the time here.
And did you see a lot of Serb forces burning?
Yes, before they are coming near house, but we always must avoid them because we have all the time they are coming, and we thought that they are coming in the end, and you see now again. I don't know. But of course that we feel safe now because the NATO forces are here, but we don't see too much Serb forces, and when there's no Serb police, no Serb army here, doesn't mean that no crimes, no killings.
How does it make you feel as an Albanian to see what appears to be an Albanian home burning next to a mosque? How does this make you feel?
But I feel troubled because we live too much of burning, we live too much of killing, of crime, and to see again this is...
Do you have any sense that maybe this is Serb forces leaving a last...
I think that it's possible. It's possible.
What is your name?
Valent.
Valent, and the family name?
Velice.
How old are you?
I come from Kandira, from Drenica, and I don't know anything about my family for 3 months. They are in bridges, or I don't know.
You don't know where they are?
No. For 3 months. Any information. I'm going.
Are you afraid that as NATO comes in and as Serb forces remain here,
yes,
that they're going to step up attacks against Albanians before they leave?
Yes, we are afraid, but I decided to get out because for 3 months I was just inside and I decided to get out and to see and to say welcome now.
That was a young Albanian student standing outside of a building next to a mosque that was burning down yesterday as we were there watching the building go up in flames. Now, simultaneously, there was another building burning across town, this time in front of a building that was predominantly Serb. And the residents there said they did not know who set the fire, but they said they have been receiving calls in the past few days telling them that they need to leave. And this is one of the men standing outside of the home inside of a Serbian apartment complex.
Pa ne zna se, ali mi dobijamo pozive svako pola sata, sat, da moramo da se selimo, nemamo šta da čekamo, jer UČK dolazi da nas kolju.
I don't know who set the fire, but we are receiving calls every half an hour. They're telling us to leave because we have nothing to do here, and that the KLA is coming here to slaughter us.
That was a Serbian man standing outside of a burning building in a Serbian apartment complex, Amy.
Jeremy, how willing are people to speak to you? How difficult is it?
It's extraordinarily difficult. First of all, I'm working with a translator who is Serbian, and there's an enormous amount of animosity toward her on the part of Albanians. They want nothing to do with anyone who is speaking Serbian. They don't believe that the translation will be accurate, and so they're very, very skeptical. It ranges from being skeptical to outraged or angry at my translator, and I think a lot of Serbian civilians are outraged at me being from the United States, and so a lot of people say they will not talk to me. I've also been threatened several times by people on the street saying that they would love nothing more than to beat up a foreign journalist. As I said, the tension here is extraordinarily high, and yesterday rose that level even higher. Only 20 minutes after British forces rolled into the city of Pristina, they killed a Serbian man. They claim that he fired on them, though that is very, very, it's very difficult to know what exactly happened. There are conflicting reports. People who witnessed it say he wasn't firing at them but was firing up in the air, which is something you see all over the place, people firing off guns constantly. But the British paratroopers fired on him, saying that they were returning fire in self-defense, and they gunned him down. And actually, Robert Fisk, who is familiar to Democracy Now! Listeners, a reporter for the Independent of Britain, commented when he heard the press conference we're about to hear from that it's a press conference you hear often in Belfast from the very same forces. So this is a spokesperson from the British Army shortly after K4 forces killed the first Serbian during this occupation.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Mick Chizet, and I am the spokesman for the British element of K4. I can confirm but at 16:28 hours today, an incident occurred in the area behind me. A K-4 patrol came under unprovoked fire at close range. The patrol repeatedly warned the individual to stop or they would fire. The individual continued to threaten the soldiers with his weapon, and fire was returned in self-defense. Regrettably, the individual was killed. The soldiers, the K-4 soldiers concerned, acted clearly and unequivocally within the K-4 rules of engagement. K-4 has made it very clear throughout this operation that it has robust rules of engagement and will take action to protect itself against aggression. The incident will now be thoroughly investigated by the military police. We expect all parties here to operate with restraint in order to bring peace and stability to Kosovo. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
We believe the man. I'd like to know whether the man was actually shooting at the paratroopers or whether he was shooting in the air. That's
or
a
was
very
he
important
shooting?
Question.
Was he shooting?
The paratroopers were shot at.
Directly at them. He was aiming the gun at them. Is that correct, sir?
They came under fire.
Was he aiming the gun at them, sir? It's a very important question.
I said what I said.
Thank
How
you.
Many rounds did he fire, sir? At least one round. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. That will be it. Thank you very much.
Now, Amy, the journalist that you heard questioning them further was, in fact, Robert Fisk, and we do not have additional information on that killing. There are reports that he was an off-duty reservist military police officer, and it's interesting to note that he was gunned down by the KFOR forces in front of a known bar that is a hangout for Serbian paramilitaries, as well as the army and police, a bar called the Calypso, in a housing project just inside Pristina, actually right across the street from the hotel that I'm speaking to you from right now. The scene on the streets right now is extraordinarily tense. People are very, very terrified, both Albanian civilians and Serbian civilians. They very much fear being caught in a crossfire once again between retreating Serbian forces and the KLA, but it does very much seem like the KLA is being given a free rein to move into positions that they did not hold previously. It does not seem like there's any noticeable disarmament going on of the KLA, and it also at the same time seems as though Serb forces are burning homes as they're leaving. It seems as though they are looting property as they are leaving. And so it is a very, very intense war zone right now in the streets of Pristina.
Jeremy, the Serb forces have, I think, until something like June 20th to leave. What do their convoys out look like, the military leaving Kosovo?
Well, it's interesting, Amy. They actually look like they have many, many weapons still intact. You do see many surface-to-air missiles going out of the country. You also see large tanks and jeeps going out. There are also reports that the Russians are taking over some of the Yugoslav tanks at the military airport as we speak right now and using those. But the Serbian forces very obviously have taken an extraordinary blow from NATO. The soldiers that we talked to wouldn't talk on tape, but they did say that we wouldn't believe what they've seen over the last few months and the last year. I think that was a reference to not only what has happened to them, but what they also have done. A friend of mine here that I met in Belgrade has a friend that is in a mental institution right now, a psychiatric hospital. He was in Kosovo, and he had a nervous breakdown, and he just said to her, we would go into a village, and then the next day that village would be gone. So I think that the Serbian soldiers have not only done some atrocious things that have scarred their psyche, but they've also seen some atrocious things. And, of course, the ethnic Albanians here have suffered enormously, and there is a lot of anger and outrage and bitterness toward all Serbians, not just the Serbian military. There also is an extraordinarily high...
Yes. We have to wrap up now. We only have a few seconds, and I want to thank you very much for being with us from Pristina, Kosovo. You will be continuing to bring us this report, this chronicle of the occupation of Kosovo tomorrow on Democracy Now! Thank you. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Michael Eid is our headlines editor. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! They tell it so well.
This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Pacifica Network News for Monday, June 14th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A report from Pristina on NATO's entry into the capital and the exit of thousands of Kosovar Serbs. The standoff between NATO and the Russian forces in Kosovo continues. And two more victims of police shootings. This time, the officers are black. First, these news headlines. NATO officials said so far 10,000 Yugoslav soldiers left Kosovo as more than 14,000 NATO troops entered. A few hundred Russian troops are still holding the airport at Pristina, the Kosovo force, or K for Commander Lieutenant General Mike Jackson, said.
This is one of these myths that's arisen, no doubt to accentuate the spice of the story. I might have put my tactical headquarters there for a short while. Frankly, now I've